I want America to understand, this week, it's going to get bad. And we really need to come together as a nation. I heard the stories that you were just playing, young people out on beaches. We see here in D.C. that the district set up a cam for people to watch the cherry blossoms. You look on the cam, you see more people walking around than you see cherry blossoms. And this is how the spread is occurring. And so we really, really need everyone to stay at home.
You don't think people are taking it seriously?
That was Surgeon General Jerome Adams on the Today Show this morning. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Reason Roundtable. I am Matt Welch, joined from their remote locations by Peter Suderman, Nick Gillespie, and Catherine Mankiw-Ward. Howdy, folks.
Howdy.
Hey, Matt.
Happy Monday.
Nope. So it's a somber day on a whole lot of fronts as we prepare for what's looking like a tidal wave of coronavirus cases to overrun hospital and ICU capacity in cities like New York, while also observing all around us an already crashed economy whose effects will be with us for God knows how long. But before we delve into all of that, I wanted to talk up top about something that's making me even a little bit sadder right now, which is that a longtime friend of Reason and of the libertarian movement, I should say, the conservative movement, yeah, and especially the anti-war movement, John Basilotti died on Friday after a long and very well-lived life. John, for those who don't know him, and please go and Google him as much as you can, J-O-N, and then Utley is U-T-L-E-Y. He was the publisher of The American Conservative, a key financial backer of antiwar.com, an absolutely steadfast regular at Reason Weekend conferences, and someone who had a deep intellectual interest in the oil extraction industry. You wrote a bunch of great stuff for Reason about that. Mostly, he would just show up to wherever there were libertarians and or conservatives. I think probably most commonly at Grover Norquist's Wednesday meeting in Washington, D.C., and always in this very soft-spoken, gentle type of way would inject non-interventionist foreign policy ideas, regardless of how hawkish the room or the moment was. One thing you'll see when in all the various remembrances of John that's coming up is that he was just such a sweet, sweet, tempered man, happily spreading generosity all around him. I was one of, probably thousands of beneficiaries of that when I moved to Washington, D.C. in 2008. He threw a party to welcome me, which I really appreciate. And he was always trying to get certain libertarians to stop attacking me online to no real effect. But he just wanted everyone to be focused on the common goal of what we're all trying to do together. So deepest condolences to his son, Bill, and his surviving family. We all had different interactions with him. Nick, can you talk a little bit about parts of his biography that are just jaw-dropping and that Reason TV did some video work with back in the day?
Yeah, John was, as you were saying, Matt, is just one of the kindest and most generous people that I've ever met, and not just personally, but also intellectually. And he was a living page from history. His father was actually a trade official in the Stalinist regime in Russia. His mother, Frieda Utley, had been a kind of parlor pink in England in the 20s and 30s, and actually moved to the Soviet Union with her husband, who was disappeared, by the secret police in Russia, and ended up dying in the labor camps in Vorkuta, in Siberia. And John, among other things, if people want to learn something about him, they can go to reason.com and Google John Utley's search for his father. Shortly after the Soviet Union collapsed, he was able to go to the former Soviet Union and study in archives, which were briefly open. And he was finally able, after decades, to find out what had actually happened to his father. And there's a great documentary that was put together by people from Boston University originally, which we ran. Very happy to have run that. And it is a searing, amazing kind of documentary about what life was like in the world that John was literally born into and managed with his mother to escape from. What I will always take away from John Utley is that even though he was this elder statesman and he came across very much as a man of, lived after World War II, but almost a pre-war man of kind of intellectual and cosmopolitan demeanor. His roots were he was born in the Soviet Union. He was a forward-looking person who was both anti-war as well as pro-social liberalism. I mean, this guy lived a libertarian life deep in his bones in a way that I think all of us that pretend to be libertarians aspire to. And so I would recommend checking out John Utley's Search for His Father, which is a reminder of like a horrible past, but also a kind of testament to a man who really embodied a forward-looking vision of a world that was based on trade and commerce, voluntary cultural exchange, and a laissez-faire attitude towards people living the lives that they want to live peacefully and cooperatively.
Catherine, you want to chime in?
Just that he was a good model for the current moment of how you can disagree very, very strongly with people about things that you think have life and death stakes and still not be just an asshole all the time.
Yeah. And, you know, to build on that too, it's, you know, I came to know him in the early 2000s. He had been supporting kind of right of center and libertarian, groups for his entire life. But right after 9/11, I mean, he was one of the few people who absolutely refused to get whipped up into war fever and into the worst kinds of immediate payback, Islamophobia. And this was a man who was not a religious man. He understood the role and the values of religion in people's lives and things like that. But just somebody who had a not only a deep understanding of history and its vagaries, but also just a refusal to freak out over anything, whether it was environmental despoliation or terrorism. The most principled and I think in many ways the most convincing critic of American foreign policy as it's played out over, since World War II, really unflappable in the best sense of the word, and so deeply committed to ideals that we would all benefit from discussing and kind of embodying more fully.
Yeah, there's not a particularly long list of people who are anti-communist to their bones and also anti-U.S. interventionist, and he's definitely on them. It's actually fitting to kind of transition from thinking about John's reaction and unflappability to 9/11 to the world that we are in right now, and then which is dealing with coronavirus, and which is one of the big three things that have happened to us over the last two decades. We are up to 33,000 cases and 430 deaths in the United States so far. One of the newest and most controversy-generating positive tests came yesterday for Senator Rand Paul. Has a lot of people in the Senate freaked out. New York has become an epicenter of the outbreak, with officials warning that we have just days left before capacity is overwhelmed. Lawmakers in Capitol Hill are arguing bitterly over what is looking like a $1.8 trillion stimulus bailout plan. The Federal Reserve this morning announced a set of new unprecedented steps to buy up debt. The Fed Bank of St. Louis president James Bullard predicted that unemployment may hit as high as 30% in the second quarter. I think we're about ready to be absolutely staggered by the number of jobless in this country once they start being reported. And President Trump this morning started to sound warnings that the cure of shutting down the economy might be worse than the disease, and stressing that we'll be revisiting the kind of stay-at-home policies within 15 days. Since we are geographically split on this podcast between New York and Washington, which are two of the most impacted cities, I thought it would be useful to talk sort of anecdotally, because a lot of our listeners are in places that are either not impacted or are heavily, heavily impacted and about ready to go through all kinds of hell. I'm thinking there in terms of New Orleans and in South Florida. So let's just sort of describe our experiences a bit. Nick, I saw you on Twitter, I think it was, having a picture of the Oculus shopping mall, which is this crazy, you know, butterfly spider looking structure near Ground Zero at, I believe, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And it was more empty than Night of the Living Dead. What have you seen around you in New York, and how has it affected your kind of day to day existence?
I've spent a lot of the past week taking long walks around Manhattan, particularly lower Manhattan. And it's, you know, it's more desolate than I've ever seen. People are out a little bit, but even as I'm looking out my window now on Bleecker Street near the intersection of Bowery, which is normally very busy, there's literally no pedestrian or automobile traffic. And that shot on Oculus, which is up on a piece that I just posted at Reason.com as well, it's, you know, it was empty. I was there with my girlfriend, and we, you know, we were one of about 10 people in this place that normally would have had thousands of people in it. And, you know, that's where we're at with this stuff.
Yeah, I'm also in New York and Brooklyn. And it's this weird kind of people. It was a beautiful day on Saturday and parts of Sunday, and everyone wants to go out and sniff the flowers and things. And they have this sort of look on their face like, should I get close? No. And the other like minor detail, but holy cow. Am I suddenly on a bunch of WhatsApp groups? I mean, a lot of them. It's pretty funny. The tech thing, like I think there's probably this rough estimate here. 11 kajillion kids used Zoom this morning, including both of mine in distance learning. As all that ramps up, it's amazing to see how technology is being used. And thank God for it too, because people are doing. Not, well, I forget what it's called, like some kind of a video hangout thing where everyone's like drinking together. We did that with our local Frenchie parents who were all freaking out over access to wine. But thankfully we were able to have at least some human interaction using these technological things. Catherine, what's going on there in Washington, D.C., aside from you hanging out in Rock Creek Park all day long?
I am hanging out in Rock Creek Park all day long. Very good social distancing in places where you would go if you were already being thoughtful about social distancing. So if you were going for a walk in Rock Creek because you thought it would be a good way to stay away from people, people are having super good etiquette on the trails and on the walks of staying clear of each other and really giving each other space. I yesterday did a neighborhood tour with my kids to do play dates from a virally safe distance. So we went to their friends' houses, and their friends stood on their stoop and we stood down on the sidewalk, or, you know, down a flight of stairs or whatever it was, and just kind of said hello and saw each other in person briefly without being anywhere near close enough to breathe on each other. And it was surprisingly refreshing. It was actually, I think of myself obviously as being a bit of a grumpy person who doesn't always love people, but I was really happy to see some faces other than the faces of my family in real life. That said, it felt crazy. It felt like we're living on the edge, and yet we were being super, super careful. I imagine that even that will probably fade as people become more aware and as the death toll increases in the coming week, just because an abundance of caution is the right approach. But that was it. That was like it was each encounter was about 2 minutes, but it was still very striking to see someone else's face. I do want to come back, I assume we will, on this podcast to the ways in which seemingly frivolous digital tools have now become the main thing that is holding our society together.
Yes.
Because I think that's a really, really important thing for us to talk about. I am on WhatsApp. I am on Marco Polo. I am on Homeroom. I am on Zoom. I am on Slack chat. I am on Google Hangouts. And it is incredible and important.
Sunderman, I assume that your life hasn't changed even a little bit, except for now you get to valorize your playing single-person shooters at home in the pages of the New York Times because coronavirus.
To be fair, he did that before.
So in that sense, it still hasn't changed. Yes, I am fortunate enough to have been able to publish a piece about why, if you are effectively trapped inside your home, you should play video games. It's a kind of palliative care, right? It's it both allows for being alone. It allows you to go someplace. A lot of video games are virtual places. And it also, in some cases, allows you to connect with other people since games are social experiences. My life has changed in a couple of notable ways, though, with all the closures, because what got closed down, for the most part, were movie theaters and bars. And I go to bars and restaurants, and I go to movie theaters on a really regular basis. And I have to say that the moment at which I felt most sad and most sort of broken up by all this was just actually last Monday night, after we recorded the podcast last time, when it was right after the order in DC came down that all the bars had to close. It wasn't just that they had to implement social distancing measures, that all the movie theaters had to close. And I was just, you know, scrolling through my Instagram feed and looking, you know, at Twitter and seeing all these people who I follow a lot of bars. I follow a lot of sort of bartenders and those accounts, and seeing all of these businesses that were being forced to shut down, seeing all of these places of life and vitality and sort of and social connection and of wonderful art and entertainment and of enjoyment, places that I spend a fair amount of time, and that even when I'm not spending time, I'm really interested in, and places that even beyond me provide a livelihood to millions of people across the country, and they're all gone now, kind of unexpectedly, you know, in the space of a week. And, you know, Catherine talked about how important it is to think about the way that digital tools are enabling our social lives. And that's very true in big business, and social media and digital tools are stepping up and providing right now in a way that that I think people wouldn't have thought a month ago. It's sort of eerie to walk around Washington, D.C. right now and just to see everything kind of closed or nearly closed, and to see the emptiness of it. And it is, to me, it is just a reminder of how important commerce is, and how much, even if you're not participating in it, even if you're going, if you're walking from your house to go for a walk in the park or just out for a walk with your dog, having things that are open, places that are buying and selling, places that you can gather, that's an incredibly important part of life, of community, of society. It's
cheerful.
It is lost for millions of people right now.
It's absolutely cheerful. I mean, I everywhere I've lived over the last 30 years, I even have sort of a phrase of with my wife let's look for a neighborhood where there's a lot of commerces. You know, it's just cheerful to have a lot of stores and people selling stuff. It's part of life. It makes you happy. If I'm down, I walk around the neighborhood. I live in a nicely commercial neighborhood in Brooklyn, and it cheers me up always. And so that's hard to see that go. Let's stick with the kind of economic impact, Peter, and stick with Peter as well, to maybe walk us through a little bit about what the disputes are over the federal package and the various trillions, and what's the differences between the parties on this, what's going on, and what are the basic approaches being taken so far on a federal level in terms of bailout or stimulus or however you want to characterize it.
Yeah, so Congress is negotiating a package is being referred to as a stimulus package. I would describe it a little bit differently as either a recovery package, or even I've heard some people use, you know, a little bit ironically, but the word reparations package, that is going to be in the neighborhood of $1.8, maybe even $2 trillion here. And that's what's going on in Congress. That plan there, the rough outlines of it are that they would provide a direct payment of $1,200 to most Americans, who make about $75,000 a year, $500 for children. So you could conceivably see a family earning $150,000 from two incomes, with a couple of kids getting $2,400 plus $1,000, so, you know, $3,400 or something like that. There's been some controversy over that provision just because the payments ramp up as you get to $75,000 and then ramp down as you get to $100,000 in income. And so you can imagine situations in which low-income single parents actually get less than, say, a household with two earning parents that makes $150,000 a year. And there's some people who are who think, I think reasonably, that that's, that there's a, some inequity there. There's also some business payments, $350 billion for small businesses intended to stop layoffs, some money for hospitals and unemployment insurance. And then probably the biggest sticking point right now is a $500 billion program for businesses that is basically a slush fund for the Treasury Department to dole out money to businesses. And what Democrats are concerned is that this would allow Trump, who can appoint or fire a Treasury secretary, it would allow Trump to just sort of give money to whoever, whatever businesses are his friends, whatever businesses he likes at any point. And so if you want to read the strongest version of the objection to this, it comes from Jonathan Chait in New York Magazine, who just argues that this is absolutely a recipe for corruption for Trump to say, spend a lot of money, give a lot of money to his own businesses. At the same time, Democrats are pushing a bill of their own, and it has a whole bunch of stuff that Democrats always want, according to Twitter reports. It includes new collective bargaining power for unions. It includes increased fuel emission standards for airlines, expansion of wind and solar tax credits. So right now, everybody in Congress is kind of treating this not quite as business as usual, because this is much bigger than anything they would be doing usually, but it, they are treating it as an opportunity to do the things that they already want to do. Everybody's kind of behaving badly, and it's not really a great situation. And then there's a huge Fed program as well that I should just briefly mention. The Fed has taken unprecedented steps, basically says we are going to be the buyer of last resort for corporate bonds, and we're going to find some way to funnel money to small businesses. We don't exactly know what that is. In some ways, the Fed announcement this morning, which came on the heels of a previous announcement last week that they were lowering rates and also commencing with some bond buying, the Fed announcement is basically saying, look, Congress, the White House, you guys have not gotten your act together. We are going to step in and do business side stimulus for you. And it may end up being that the Fed does more here, regardless of what Congress passes.
Catherine, I recognize that I'm about to ask a pacifist what type of weapon she enjoys shooting people with. But that actually makes sense, right? That wasn't so bad.
That worked. I'm so proud of you.
Thank you. But categories of stimuli, bailout, what are better than others, or what are worse than others, maybe is the way to look at it, if we're having this? Or are you just going to reject the question altogether because you're a damn ANCAP?
Yeah, I mean, I have long held the position that if there is going to be any money transferred from the state to individuals, to anyone for the purposes of achieving social ends, that it should always go to individuals in the form of essentially unrestricted checks. So this is never a good policy to use in real life, which is one reason that I then collapse back into anarchism, because it's always done in addition to rather than instead of bailouts, industry-specific grants, targeted tax cuts, that kind of thing. But in a world in which I need to intervene in the economy, and you ask me what is the least bad way to do that, the answer is to give individual people money and let them decide how to spend it. This is a rule across the board. This is also the best way to do charity. This is also the best way to do, you know, charity both at the macro level and at the micro level. Give people cash and let them make their own decisions. That causes the least distortion in the economy in most cases. And it doesn't bog us down in this wrangling about, well, which of Donald Trump's friends is going to get that $500 billion? Or should the airlines be getting a loan or a direct, you know, grant? Should we have this number of, you know, tax exemptions for this industry and not that industry? Should we bail out the cruise industry at all? I would rather not have any of those conversations because they're not productive and don't typically yield efficient results. So if you give this pacifist a gun, that's what she would say. But I don't think that unfortunately we get a scenario in which we do just that. And so then the question becomes, well, what are the costs of just increasing the baseline spending? Since as we've noted earlier, there are real questions about why I should be getting a check at all right now, given that my household has two workers who are still getting paid and lots of households don't.
So one argument for that is that just you can tax that money back. But I actually just want to raise the question, since it's one that I've been wrestling with. A lot of the people who are out of work right now, a lot of the businesses that are shut down not because they failed, not because they did anything really wrong, but because their state governor or their mayor has said, you have to shut down. And so the argument that I've heard from even some libertarian types is that this is not an ordinary economic stimulus. This is not an ordinary recession. This is, in fact, a government-ordered recession in which government is effectively taking the livelihoods from bartenders, from restaurant owners, from theater chain owners, and saying, you cannot make a living. You cannot run your business. And that therefore the government, in the same way that when it takes resources, say, to fight a war, or when it uses eminent domain, this is a kind of takings, and the government owes them back. And so, since this is directly ordered by the government, and arguably the fault of government failures, notably the CDC and the FDA completely botching the rollout of testing, which if we'd had massive testing at this point, we might have been able to do, we might have been not had to do quite the kind of restrictive measures that we have taken in many cities and states right now. Since this is the fault of government, don't they owe people who, workers and business owners, for taking their livelihoods from them? Again, I'm not saying I necessarily endorse this, but I do think it's different than a typical recession, even than the Great Recession, in that this isn't a failure of underlying economic conditions or businesses just not doing what they should have been doing. This is the government saying, your business no longer exists, at least for some period of time.
So I actually think that's a really, really helpful framework to think about this. But in the end, the reason that that fails for me as a way to rationalize certain types of grants or loans over and above others is that it presumes a kind of justice or equity or some value at all in the original starting point, right? Like, we were already living in a condition where government was constantly prohibiting people from earning livings. You know, this is occupational licensing. This is all these different things that Reason writes about all the time. And in those circumstances, I think it becomes readily apparent that trying to craft an elaborate system of grants or assistance to people who are harmed by government action would itself be a harmful government action. So that's the place where it sort of seems to collapse on itself to me. But I do think that is the most libertarian compatible or kind of market compatible way to think about how you might frame up support, especially for small businesses.
Hey, Nick, remembering back to the 2008 financial crisis and the panicky, rushed bills that were passed at the time, and including things that have been memory-holed, such as they voted on bailing out the auto companies and didn't vote for it, but they bailed out the auto companies anyways by pretending that they were banks. There's going to be a lot of discussion or callbacks to that era of saying, as Joe Biden pointed out, I believe at the 2012 Democratic National Convention, hey, you know what? Osama bin Laden's dead. And General Motors is alive. Like, that was good what we did with General Motors. And so therefore, we should do that with fill in the blank industries, including the cruise industries, which are not American.
Yep. And casinos are asking for
so
a bailout.
So as someone who remembers that era, why are those arguments bad? Or what are people forgetting about the terms and processes of those previous bailouts? And you might even throw in like airlines after 9/11.
Yeah, I mean, this is, I think it's absolutely important to think about all of this stuff in relation to 9/11 and what came after that, as well as the financial crisis. And I think any starting point of any conversation has to be that the government has simultaneously screwed up the response, as Peter and Catherine were both talking about, in terms of not just failing to do the testing that was necessary and was obviously called for, but then preventing other parts of the government or private sector actors from doing that. But now they're going, you know, they overreacted by effectively shutting down the entire economy of the country, pulling it to a screeching halt. And now they are going to overreact by now trying to make everybody whole in the name of doing what government is supposed to do in a crisis, which itself is partly government created. This it's not going to end well. I think the best that you can hope for is that the government, first off, do whatever it can to either speed up the medical response. And right now, we need to, you know, if you read the accounts of what the coronavirus is and the actual major health threats that it causes, what we need is massive testing and identifying of people who are infected and then quarantining them. And that should be the primary focus of everything. And then trying to get the economy back on track as quickly as possible, not by the government necessarily bailing everything out, but by allowing people to go about their business once we know whether or not we're infected and what we do when we find people who are infected. This is, you know, we're not even fully into week two of the 15-day, wait and see period that the federal government has announced. And this is already starting to get very squirrely. And I'm seriously concerned what happens at the end of this week when the federal government is going to say, you know what, the peak has not been reached, so we're going to go down for another 15 days of lockdown, et cetera. There aren't any good options here. The best thing that you can do is to, you know, is to ramp up the medical response and also build capacity there. And the government can pay for that directly. And then they should be giving money to the people who need it most. And that's not going to be any of the people on this call. And if the government can't figure out who needs the money most, then we are and deliver it to them expeditiously. I don't know where you go from there, other than dreaming up fictional responses that later in the day, like the way you're talking about Joe Biden, you know, there's this myth that is persistent and has now passed into fact that the stimulus that was started by George Bush and completed by the Obama administration somehow helped avert an economic crisis. It didn't. It extended an economic crisis, which in large part was due to government action.
Let's hit on a bit of what Nick wrote about this morning at Reason.com, which, and we've used a lot, I think all of us have used at some point the word overreaction to describe this. First of all, I would just inject in here a couple of notes. One is that the country of Hungary, among others, is responding to the crisis by taking all kinds of emergency measures. They're talking about maybe having government being able to act via decree instead of acts of parliament. We talked about it on last week's podcast. Nick was especially sounding the warning bell against, you know, things, bad things that will last afterwards. And we're starting to see that. There was over the weekend, a Department of Justice kind of trial balloon about taking sort of emergency measures that looked pretty onerous and terrible. But my question is about the word overreaction. Do we all agree that, in fact, what we're seeing does constitute that? It's my instinct that it does. I wrote a piece saying as much against curfews and against lockdowns in pragmatic worry against supply chains, to specifically those hospitals and the capacities and the whatnots for us to be able to deal with. But I'm also haunted sitting here, you know, next to in one of the most affected cities by this bit of math that only like struck me yesterday. So I'll share it with you for people who are as dumb as I am, which is 1.3 to the 10th power, 1.3 being the amount of transmission normally associated with the flu. I get the flu, I'm going to transmit it to 1.3 people. They're going to transmit it to 1.3 and so on. So 1.3 to the 10th power is 14. 2.3 to the 10th power, 2.3 being a pretty rough guess of the transmissibility rate of COVID-19. 2.3 to the 10th power is over 4,000. it's kind of terrifying when you think about it like that. So, Catherine.
Yeah, so wait, but think about it this way. We spend all of our time in normal times talking about how it isn't right that the government, you know, the government, when we're talking about something like stop and frisk, where the government can say, look, here's a population of people that we think are going to commit a lot of crime, so we're going to preemptively lock them up. You know, we worry about the overreaction in that kind of situation. The same thing is happening here. The fact is that, first off, infection isn't the only issue. The real ultimate, the case has to do with fatality. And there hasn't been a lot of movement on the idea that the coronavirus case fatality rate is 1% among people who get infected. You know, we are overreacting. And what we should be doing is calibrating a response that gets to the people who are infected and who are likely to transmit things, particularly to older populations or people with underlying health conditions that are going to be, you know, most at risk of dying. That's what we should be triaging. Instead, we're saying to everybody at every level of society, you have to act as if you are a 70-year-old man, you know, with emphysema and a bunch of other problems. That creates such a stress on the social situation that it makes it harder, even for those people who are most likely to be endangered, to act in accordance with the law. You know, and this is not simply economists who are worrying about this kind of stuff. It's also, you know, a number of health professionals. We need a targeted response, and that's not what we're getting. So I think whatever we're doing now is definitely an overreaction. And ironically, it's going to spur up a lack of compliance with the types of public health measures that would actually get us through this more quickly and with less damage.
The problem is we can't do a targeted response right now. And the reason we can't do a targeted response right now is because the CDC completely botched the development of the testing. First, they said we're going to be the only ones to do it. And then their initial test kit was faulty and had to be recalled. So it took even longer. And then the FDA has to certify all of these. And the FDA took way too long to certify private companies, which are, in fact, much better than the CDC, equipped to produce mass testing kits. And so we had just a catastrophic failure of government in the run-up to this. And that was exacerbated, I think, by President Trump saying, well, this isn't a big deal. You know, the fact that I'm failing is a hoax created by the media here. This is, you know, we've only got a couple of cases, and I think it'll probably go away. The numbers are very good right now. Don't worry about this. And so as a result of a failure of bureaucracy, a failure of leadership, we don't have visibility on what the actual problem is and what the actual numbers and spread are. And that makes it very difficult to do the sort of targeted testing, quarantining, case tracing that has worked better in other countries, in the countries that have dealt with this best. But even in the countries that have dealt with this best, they have gone through extended periods of pretty significant restrictions on commerce for the most part. And there just aren't many examples of other countries that have gotten through this, even with better results than we are likely to have, where they didn't close down a lot of stuff. And so I'm not sure we're overreacting. I do think we are reacting badly. And I do think that the government's response in the past,
I think that's an important distinction,
8 to 12 since the beginning of the year has generally been awful and has probably ensured that thousands, if not tens or even hundreds of thousands of Americans are going to die unnecessarily here.
Catherine, take us.
Yeah, I think that this is a place where it continues to be really, really important to disentangle, to the extent that we can, the public health response from the economic response. We cannot disentangle them completely, but there is a huge, huge difference between saying, listen, everyone needs to stay home. We need to get our testing in order. We need to get our vaccine work up to as much speed as we can. Those are things that we need to get medical supplies to the right places. Those are things where even a very minimal minarchist would say, okay, the state, do it. Go ahead. Do your thing. But that is immediately being conflated by virtually everyone in every conversation with the question of whether we need to send giant checks, whether we need to mint two beautiful platinum $1 trillion coins at the mint, which is apparently a thing we do when we do this kind of massive massive intervention in the economy.
Well, it's a thing we talk about,
right? It's a little bit of theater that makes the magic work. But I think it's just so important to distinguish between saying everyone has to stay home. This is a public health imperative. We are going to do this until it's clear that it's safe. And saying we have to intervene in the economy massively. Like there will be massive economic implications of everyone staying home. But the place where we are overreacting and reacting badly is on the economic side of the ledger. It's much less clear to me that we are overreacting or even reacting badly on the public health side of the ledger, and separating those is crucial and not happening at all in the general conversation.
We should talk about New York just real quick, because New York is the center of this. It's where two of our podcast participants live. And if this goes really badly, it's going to go really badly in New York first over the next few weeks. And so when I talked about our lack of visibility, we're going to get it, unfortunately, by looking at what happens in New York hospitals in the next 2 to 4 weeks. And so in some ways, you know, we should come back to this conversation and ask whether or not what New York has done, where you have basically everybody ordered to stay inside with the exception of, you know, going for jogs or walking your dog, going to the grocery store. We should come back to this, because the cases that we're seeing over the next 2 to 3 weeks are going to be people who were infected prior to the lockdown orders. And so that's going to start to tell us how bad this is and how bad it could get in the United States. And unfortunately, we've got to wait and see the death counts in the hospitals rather than actually seeing cases out in the wild through
infection
effective
levels
mass
in
testing.
The public. Yeah.
Nick, you were saying.
No, I, you know, we're going to be, there is no way to say then that this wasn't an overreaction, or that this was an overreaction, because whatever happens, everybody will say this happened because the right policies were followed or the wrong policies were followed. And I think that there has been a premature quickness to shut everything down in the names of public health without any consideration of economics. And I'm not talking about the government bailing things out. I'm talking about, you know, the Wall Street Journal had a piece that's only about 5 days old saying that, you know, the economic health of a country is as important as the physical health when you're dealing with something like coronavirus, because we're not dealing with, you know, it's not Ebola, it's not the Black Plague, it's not anything like that. And I think that we have jumped very quickly from a more rounded and robust discussion of all of the different factors that go into public health to focusing simply on the transmission of a disease that is going to kill 1%. We're not in the business of saying, okay, a certain number of deaths is unavoidable or is okay or we can live with. But the fact of the matter is that we have squelched any discussion of a broader set of outcomes that are important. And, you know, what happens when you factor in from the effects of quarantine, the mental health effects, the suicide rates that go up, the loss of businesses, because, you know, already there are going to be, and I'm sure of this in New York, there are going to be a ton of businesses that have closed that are never coming back. And it's going to be very difficult to understand the ripple effects of that and count that against whatever we saved, because a bunch of young people who are healthy and who will get infected with the coronavirus and will help actually develop herd immunity to it will have no bad effects and will not necessarily be infecting anybody who's going to die from it, are not allowed to go about their business and have some kind of economic activity that would allow more businesses to survive and would allow us to flourish, you know, down the road. I and, you know, this cat is out of the bag at this point, because we have definitively, you know, I mean, this is the beginning of the lockdown, because virtually every state, every major city has locked down. I'm sure this week we will get a national shelter in place type of law, which people have been calling for. And I think Donald Trump has been wise to avoid leaving it to governors, but we're going to get that. And, you know, it's mostly a question of what do we do when this passes and how do we actually account for what went on? What are the counterfactuals and how do we start thinking about better policies going forward?
There's going to be an opportunity for federalism here, though, that I think we may well miss, but that I hope we don't, and that perhaps we can extend some of the kind of current current policy of letting state governors take charge here and do this, because, you know, there's a very good piece by Scott Gottlieb, who I think has been very serious and very good on this stuff, in the Wall Street Journal this over the weekend, who basically argued that after we get mass testing up and ready and available everywhere, what we're going to be able to do is tailor and target our policies to local outbreaks. And that may mean that some places do have to have quite restrictive policies in terms of movement and commerce and what can be open and not, but not everywhere will. And we'll be able to actually fight it, you know, sort of city by city rather than with national one-size-fits-all orders, which I think would be at least preferable to the current trajectory.
I'm pretty optimistic about in the kind of long, long run about being able to learn some lessons from the different state and locality reactions here in the United States that will be much harder to learn using inter-country comparisons. This is a silver lining for way down the road, but we will see states not only, you know, obviously we've already seen states and localities handle the quarantine and shelter in place and social distancing rules differently, but we will also see states handle the recovery differently. And it is my profound hope that the nation's social scientists will bend their minds to making the best possible use of that data. It is my deep pessimistic expectation that the coming weeks and months will be a festival of confirmation bias, not just here at the Reason podcast, but all around the nation, as everyone sees that their priors were confirmed.
I think as soon as we start seeing not just dead bodies, but people not treated for other things and like horrible decisions being made or like, you know, choices having to be made. And that's just going to change the tenor of the conversation. It's going to make today look super measured in response. And it makes me very worried. But I want to go to a little bit of more of a positive vibe and kind of even playing off of what Catherine just said. And I'll throw it, in fact, back to Catherine. You wrote a piece in Politico about some kind of possible positive developments that come out of that, not just federalism, but like things like what are new policies or discontinuations of policies? Are we learning already about this that might be more broadly applicable, do you think?
Yeah. So I think, I mean, we talked a little bit at the top of the podcast about the various tools for communicating with each other online. My joke kicker to the Politico piece was a joke that has been going around the internet at quite a rapid clip, which is it turned out a lot of those meetings really could have been an email. I look forward to living in a world where a lot of those meetings become emails or...
Yeah, except a lot of those meetings are just Zoom conferences that barely work now.
Right. But you know what? I'm far, far, far more than my faith in the federal government or state governments to do anything freaking useful. I believe deeply that Zoom is going to get better and better in very short order. They are.
Oh, me too.
They are going to get that technology up and running. So I think, you know, that piece of the puzzle is a silver lining. And even though I am on effectively day one of a nightmare homeschooling situation, I think that the future of online learning and school choice is genuinely bright. We are suddenly, you know, industries that suddenly have a massively expanded market that have been struggling with the growth of their markets. That is to say, lots and lots of really smart people have been trying to innovate in the online learning space and the homeschooling space, and they have struggled for lack of demand, not for lack of supply. And so I think that there's going to be a lot of people who discover that they like those tools and want to keep using them. I don't know if it'll be me. It won't be most people. And I have to say, that was the line in my political piece that really annoyed the internet, was the notion that some people might discover that they like partial or full homeschooling. But I genuinely believe that's true. And I think that will be a good thing for kids. I'm also, I have to say, really looking forward to a future in which people are more averse to personal contact, and which our fashion includes more like gloves and cool masks. So just on a frivolous note, less hugging, more chic glove wearing is the thing that I am here for.
Peter, what innovations have you seen? And let me guess what they involve. Go.
The innovation I want to talk about most is a rollback of government rules on open container. It has, in most places in the country, been illegal to sell cocktails to go. You can't do that, right? You can't walk up to a cocktail bar and say, give me a drink and I'm going to take it out on the street. And now in quite a few cities in the United States, you can sometimes, as in Washington, D.C., they also have to sell food with your cocktail. But there is a great cocktail bar across the street from Reason's office in DuPont Circle, McClellan's Retreat. I've been there many times. I enjoy their wares quite a bit. They don't really have a kitchen, and yet they're still able to do this because they are requiring everyone to buy a bag of popcorn with their pre-batched and pre-bottled cocktails. This is the sort of thing that I think should be legal all the time, and that we talk about the kind of the policy hangover that is likely to come out of this. And a lot of those policies are going to be bad. That's what happened after September 11th with the TSA and all of that. But it's at least imaginable that there's also going to be some good policies that come out of this and that stay in place. And so I don't want to say that, hey, this is a great thing and that there's going to be, you know, this is all wonderful. But there are some microscopic bits of good news that we can look at here and places where we can say, look, we're making changes for the better that we could hopefully keep in place for the long run. And to-go cocktails, I hope, are one of them.
Nick, any pieces of innovation or policy good news or just someone doing something cool in response that you've noticed?
I have to say, I feel like we're acting, you know, we're rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic as if it's sinking, and it isn't. I mean, the country's health is going to be fine. This has been an overreaction from the beginning, which isn't to say it isn't serious. But we have been treating this as if it's the bubonic plague, and it's not. What we're seeing is the creation or the coming online of a future that was sketched out in the mid-90s in the first flush of kind of mass internet audience and the rise of the World Wide Web as a mass medium. So, you know, distance learning, only about 3% of K-12 students take a majority of their classes online. That'll go up a little bit. Obviously, it's going to more colleges will be doing a mix of residential and online learning. They've been kind of dicking around with it for decades. Work is becoming more dispersed and decentralized. People will feel more comfortable using Zoom and Skype rather than either forcing an in-person meeting or something like that. But in a lot of ways, the future that we're seeing come online now is already flourishing things like online gaming, and it's just going to become more normalized. And I think that's all good. What I worry about far more is the quickness with which government at every level of jurisdiction is going to be using health emergencies, real and imagined, in order to trigger some kind of draconian set of laws or practices or processes. You know, it's not a small thing. We screwed up the reaction to 9/11 in a major, major way. We bailed out a bunch of industries, first and foremost, the airlines en masse that didn't need it. They were dying before that. And a lot of shitty companies got an extra lease on life. You know, our foreign policy was completely screwed up as a result of 9/11. A lot of domestic policy and things like state surveillance got a massive goosing that they wouldn't have gotten otherwise. We overreacted to the financial crisis and extended it in a massive way that helped virtually nobody other than politicians who were able to run on bullshit claims that they had saved the economy from a Great Depression when, in fact, they helped bring us to the cliff of that. And I think, you know, that's where our attention has to be focused. I mean, it's good that people are living more online and more virtually and that they're understanding that the cloud is not a place that you go to die, but rather that you go to live. But the real, you know, the real emphasis has to be on what do we do to roll back what is now becoming normalized government behavior of them declaring in the absence of really good evidence and strong powers that are limited and whatnot, you know, that they can dictate business practice, that they can dictate social practice. That's what I'm worried about.
So I definitely agree this is the farthest thing from the libertarian moment. But I do also, again, want to talk about some things that I think will get reordered in a useful way. Two other things I just want to throw in are, one, it is awfully freaking hard for me to imagine that we are about to forgive every single person's student loan coming out of this. We will see, I guess. But that is one priority that I think is going to get reordered. And the other one is, you know, we're talking about at the very top of the podcast, some emissions requirements for airlines if they get bailouts. This is true in some other industries as well. I got to tell you, nobody is going to have any trouble meeting their emissions caps this year. Like, this is how you meet your emission standards, is you grind every industry to a halt. And so the reordering of the conversation around how we think and talk about climate change is going to be fascinating, because we're getting a little chance to see a natural experiment in a trade-off of economic activity for a variety of other goals. And one of them is a public health goal right now. But those emissions numbers are going to look real good from some perspectives at the end of this year. And it's not going to be because good things happened.
Let's go to our end of show cultural consumption. Suderman, what have you been consuming besides what you've been writing about, what you've been consuming?
I've been playing Doom Eternal. It's the latest installment in the old Doom franchise that has been around since the 1990s, since I was a teenager. It is fantastic. It looks great. It sounds great. It's got this ridiculous sort of over-the-top heavy metal soundtrack. This is a direct sequel to the 2016 reboot of Doom, which was just called Doom. And what it really manages to do is capture a lot of the vibe of the 1990s games with really modern gameplay and graphics. And it's just a very clever and quite entertaining blend of both. And so for people who like shooters, for people who played video games in the 1990s, for people who are into a kind of who want to like live life as a heavy metal space marine who's fighting demons that have infested the planet Earth for a little while, definitely recommend it.
Nick, what have you been consuming?
I have spent a lot of the past couple of weeks rummaging through post-apocalyptic movies from the 60s and 70s. I mentioned The Omega Man a week or two ago.
Yeah.
I watched Logan's Run, which came out in 1976. And the one thing that should make everybody feel better is that in 1976, this is pre-AIDS, this is the bicentennial year. The future vision that they had was so bad, and the one of emancipation. And this is a world in which everybody's stuck living in a big shopping mall, basically, and fucking all the time until they have to agree to be killed when they turn 30. Michael York escapes and meets Peter Ustinov with a shitty Southern accent living in the remains of the old Capitol building, brings it back to all the young people in the mall. There is one black person in the entire movie who is actually a robot that is coated in silver, played by the great black actor Roscoe Lee Brown. It is such a bad, stupid vision of a future, whether utopian, dystopian, you name it. Everything in the world is better now than it was as envisioned in Logan's Run in the world that it came. So I am actually rummaging through bad post-apocalyptic visions of the past in order to recognize that even now, even in quarantine, we have it so much better. And there's a message there that we should be, taking some hope in and gaining strength that, this will pass and we can get on with a future that's actually worth living.
Catherine, what have you been rummaging through?
I started thinking to myself, what are some good books about living in social isolation? And the answer, of course, is Jane Austen, who never even went to London in her life, I don't believe, who lived basically in the world's in a tiny world, a social circle of just a handful of people, much as we all do right now. I did a little Googling and found an academic paper from 2009 called Social Jane, The Sociology of Jane Austen by Christopher Wilkes of Pacific University, who seemed to my quick reading to recommend Mansfield Park as the most socially isolated of the Austen books. So I'm rereading Mansfield Park to figure out how to still be a good writer and observer of human nature while also only seeing a handful of humans ever.
I watched the third of a trilogy, very kind of cute, slight, funny, bohemian French trilogy by filmmaker Cédric Clapiche. It started with something that people might have heard about from, I think, the late 90s or 2002, actually, it is, called L'Auberge Espagnole, The Spanish Apartment, about a bunch of kind of young people trying to figure out their lives. I think they were in Barcelona. It's a great little movie. It was an international hit made for like $12. It became a trilogy, and I watched the third of the trilogy, or most of it at least, the other night with my daughter, partly because one of her best friends plays in it when she was 4 years old. Like, she hasn't done any acting since, but it's very funny to see, hey, look, it's old What's-Her-Face when she was four. It was very cute. But it's actually, so this movie is called Casse-Tête Chinois, or Chinese Puzzle. And it was unexpectedly moving, especially right now, and sort of poignant right now, because it's a vision. It's the kind of characters have now decamped. They're in sort of mid to late 30s. They have kids. They're going through divorces, the usual stuff. But they decamped to New York City, and they're dealing with, and this is post 9/11 New York. And there's a great meditation of like, you know, at some point, our hero is working as a bicycle messenger. And he's like, you know, there's two different New Yorks. So there's the skyscrapers and the people who are always aiming to get in the penthouses. And then there's those of us on the street level. And the street level really sucks. There's, you know, the pavement is really bad. It's kind of poetically done. But it's just very interesting. But it's also kind of a love letter to New York, especially kind of the French wide-eyed look at New York. And there are, you know, tens of thousands of French people live here, including many in my neighborhood. But it's also, you look at it and you're watching it in the context of right now, which is much more Logan's Run without the fun. And it kind of gives you a little pang. So check it out. It's called Chinese Puzzle in English, Casse-tête Chinois in French. And it's in a mix of French and English. And say hi to cute little Marco, who's in it. Okay. Hopefully next week will be less grim, but I doubt it. We'll see. Thank you for listening to the Reasoning Roundtable. Continue listening to all of our podcasts at reason.com/podcasts. And we'll check in back with everybody 7 days from now. Goodbye.